to this week's edition. Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. Webster Topley reporting from Washington, D.C. Another very full international briefing for you with marching orders. Number one marching order, emergency anti-war demonstration at Lafayette Park across from the Obama White House. That is Saturday, December 12th at 11 a.m. Stop the Obama-Pelosi-Reid escalation of the Afghan war. Under Obama-Pelosi-Reid, the U.S. has already sent 35,000 more troops into the Afghanistan graveyard of empires. Now Obama is debating another round of reinforcements, an Afghan surge expected to number about 40,000 more GIs. But there is a real reluctance by Obama, the opportunist, and a faction fight in the administration about whether to escalate. State Department forces say no. Pentagon forces say yes. Obama is getting plenty of advice from the war party, be it Holbrooke, Petraeus, McChrystal, Mullen. It is high time that Obama, Pelosi, and Reid heard a clear message from a resurgent anti-war movement demanding to an end to escalation. No escalation. U.S. to get out of Afghanistan and Iraq as fast as possible, consistent with the safety of the forces, plus an immediate halt to the cowardly and illegal murders and assassinations by these despicable predator drone attacks, and stop all CIA destabilization operations in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran. And that those three areas make up, I would venture to guess right now, the majority of all CIA activity is in those places. You see how these people work. So December 12th, it's a Saturday. It fills the bill. It's a time when working people, students, normal people can show up at a demonstration. So 11 a.m., Lafayette Park, across from the White House. You can get the Farragut West or the Farragut North Metro. This has been essentially been called by an ad hoc coalition of anti-war groups, the courageous ones, the ones that are not observing the Obama moratorium, the free ride for Barkey. And some groups are focused on demonstrations in March. Well, that's fine. You should see this as a feeder event, a way to build those March demonstrations. But what you cannot do is to simply live from anniversary to anniversary, from the Afghanistan anniversary in October to the Iraq anniversary in March, and then maybe 9/11, and then October again, and you've got your whole year planned out 10 years in advance. That is not effective politics. You've got to respond to real events. Now, Obama is still dithering. Man, is he dithering. Obama is now at least leaking out of the White House that he will not decide the escalation until after Thanksgiving. So that's essentially a week from today. That's the 26th, 27th of November. So it looks like the escalation decision, the most probably decision on how much escalation, but maybe not, that is until the end of December, not of November, not to be expected. Or maybe Obama will use his appearance to light the White House Christmas tree to announce that he's sending 40,000 more GIs. He's waiting for Advent and the coming of the Prince of Peace to show that he is the Nobel Prize winner for war and butchery and futile military operations. Now, this entire problem with Afghanistan, of course, is focused on the Afghan, Pakistan, and Iran theater. In Afghanistan, we've just had the re-inauguration of Karzai in an atmosphere where it seems like the U.S. State Department Holbrooke faction, which had been considering kicking him out, is now going to reconcile with Karzai. Of course, watch out, Karzai. That could be the prelude to the President Diem treatment, where you're found in the trunk of a car when factions in the State Department want to get rid of you. Notice also this idiotic issue of corruption. What does corruption mean? How are you going to wipe out corruption in a place like Afghanistan? Boy, if there was ever a utopian agenda, impossible, lunatic demand, the way you could eventually diminish the corruption in such a place is to give them massive economic development, a massive national program with hydroelectric infrastructure, real roads, real railroads, real pipelines going through there, real economic development, so that you could push the poppy opium narcotics economy to the sidelines. But short of that, it's a corrupt society. So what they're really saying is, Karzai, you're not allowed to do the obvious thing, which is to make deals with the various factions in Afghanistan society, which are all corrupt, and they're corrupt all around the world, but in this case, obviously corrupt. What they're saying is, we want to keep a destabilized Afghanistan government. They don't want Karzai to stabilize himself, because the day when Karzai can say, all right, I've got a peace accord, I've brought the Taliban and the Northern Alliance and the Tajiks and the Pashtuns and the Baluchis and everybody else on board, that's when the U.S. has to leave. And the point is to stay. And to stay for what? For the global war on terror? It's a bad joke. Look at the map. From Iran to China, what's in between? The Pakistani energy corridor. You could have a pipeline from the Iranian oil fields up Pakistan, going into China, above Kashmir and through the Himalayas. This would solve the number one strategic issue faced by China. Of course, China knows it. The other thing you could do is you could have a nice tanker terminal at Gwadar with a pipeline. It would basically reach into the same pipeline. So you could get oil coming from the Emirates, from Saudi Arabia, from Iraq. In this case, maybe the pipeline wouldn't be the best solution, but maybe a tanker terminal, pretty much like what the U.S. does with oil from Alaska. So the presence in Afghanistan is to block that. It's also to block the possibility of an Indo-European railroad line from Paris to New Delhi. That would have to go through Afghanistan and the Khyber Pass. So the whole point is, the U.S. wants to stay in the region in order to block economic development and to sabotage the otherwise natural tendency of these countries to find a common ground. We've also got, and I had a chance to talk about this on Russia Today this week, these recent bombings in Peshawar about 3 weeks ago, the big bomb in the women's and children's market in Peshawar, Pakistan, where the Taliban have said that they didn't do this. This was done by the U.S. and the CIA, they say, and Blackwater did it, this Z Services, as they call themselves now. They want to be a moving target. And that's simply the same idea. The purpose of the U.S. policy is to foment all-out massive civil war in Pakistan for the purpose of breaking up the country, right? Sindh, Punjab, Pashtunistan, Balochistan, Waziristan, federal tribal areas, on and on. So all of that is built in. By the way, the awareness of the U.S. role in Pakistan is so great that we have a Reuters wire from November 17th, Pakistan's Conspiracy Theories by Myra McDonald. And essentially what this says is, Pakistan is a nation of 160 million conspiracy theorists, because somehow they think that the U.S. and the British are waging a terrorist war against them using secret armies and proxies, and that these bombs that are going off all the time in Islamabad and Peshawar and other cities, that this is now the work of the U.S. and the British, CIA, MI6. Well, guess what? The 160 million Pakistani conspiracy theorists are right, and Reuters is not on the proper line here. So we'll talk about this more in just a second.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Reminding you, if you're anywhere near Washington, D.C., be in Lafayette Park across from the White House on Saturday, December 12th at 11 a.m. to stop the Obama-Pelosi-Reid escalation of the Afghan war. Peace organizations that do not protest Obama directly, now that Obama is the warmonger-in-chief and butcher-in-chief and escalator-in-chief and decider-in-chief, he's supposedly the commander in chief, if you can believe this character. Those who do not protest Obama directly at the White House by name to his address are simply exposed as shills for the Democratic Party, shills for the foundations, foundation-funded fakers who are not worth supporting. So if you've been giving money to some peace organization, you should make sure to see if they show up, if they contribute to this emergency anti-war demonstration. And the idea is to get that on the scoreboard, to send out the announcements so that you're at least having some weight thrown into the scales against the warmonger party, which dominates the White House, with the well-known warmonger Rahm Emanuel, former member of the Israeli Defense Force, who's now running the White House. So in Russia today, I was talking this week about, obviously, that the Taliban charges against the CIA are more than plausible. They're practically an open and shut case. And that then should lead to a greater awareness in Pakistan, which is what Reuters is worried about. The other thing now, we're told that the Pakistani army has successfully advanced into South Waziristan, and that simply means that there is a civil war, and that those fighters, the Pakistani Taliban in particular, have fled to other places, right? Maybe they've fled back to Peshawar. Maybe they're back in the Swat Valley now that the main forces of the Pakistani army are in South Waziristan. The other thing is the Taliban of Pakistan and the Taliban of Afghanistan, not the same thing. Taliban in Afghanistan seem to say, get out of our country and we will leave you alone. You leave us alone. We'll leave you alone, you foreign invaders. Whereas the Pakistani Taliban, much more colored with this al-Qaeda rhetoric, the caliphate, the worldwide mission, the creation of the Ummah in the entire world. So this indicates that the U.S.-British intelligence agencies are more preponderant in the Taliban on the Pakistani side, so much so that the Pakistani Taliban have been criticized by the Afghan Taliban. The Afghan Taliban say, hey, you Pakistanis who call yourself Taliban or labeled Taliban, you should stop blowing up the civilian targets because we don't do that. And notice it's the same method you saw with the Zarqawi, so-called al-Qaeda in Iraq, in reality a creation of General McChrystal. Good background on all of this, if you can read German, Christoph Herstel's excellent book, Brandherd Pakistan, the hearth of fire in Pakistan. In other words, the source of the flames is in Pakistan, and goes through the obvious roles of the CIA, MI6, the ISI, the various Mujahideen organizations on the ground. Now, shifting over to Iran, a lot of pressure on Iran. We're told that the nuclear talks with Iran have broken down to some extent, that the Iranians say they will not send their uranium out of the country to be enriched. They had originally excluded France as an enemy state under Sarkozy. Of course, that's what it is. Too bad. But not even Russia is going to be enough, they say now. So there's a meeting in Brussels of the 5+1, the permanent five of the Security Council, plus Germany, always a big player in the Iranian economy. And we're running up against these artificial lunatic deadlines that were set by Obama, right? The end of the year, well, it's almost December. What's going to happen? Now, let me stress, I still don't think that the main thing is going to be an Israeli attack on Iran. I'll be quite surprised. But I think what you got to see is that Pakistan, a much bigger and more important country, is three times as big or two and a half times as big, with nuclear weapons, with a whole series of other things that Iran does not have. That's the target, and that's one of the biggest Islamic countries in the world, if not the biggest. So Pakistan at the top of the hit list, and that's going on every day. So all the people who are worried about an attack on Iran, worry more, you should worry about an attack on Pakistan, because that's happening basically all the time. Now, we'll talk a little bit about Obama in the Far East fairly soon, but just in terms of Obama's meeting with President Hu, how ironic. These two that are making nice at the Great Wall and the Forbidden City and Beijing and all this, they are enemies in a proxy war inside Pakistan, because China is supporting the government in Islamabad, and Obama is supporting the Taliban, who are trying to wage civil war and destroy the central government in Islamabad. So the nonsensical diplomatic kabuki dance in the Forbidden City means nothing, because these countries are essentially clashing on the battlefield of Pakistan. And the only reason the U.S. does this is to remain a player in a region where the U.S. has nothing to offer to anybody. And the only way they can influence things is to prevent, sabotage, disrupt peaceful economic development. What's so threatening about an oil pipeline from Iran across Pakistan into China? Well, that's the number one thing. They also don't want a pipeline from Iran across Pakistan into India, because that would essentially set up economic cooperation, a rational basis for Iran, Pakistan, and India to face their real problems instead of the problems that have been used to divide and conquer by the State Department and the Foreign Office for lo these many years. Barkey, we're told, Obama is freaking out about all the leaks about his 8-plus meetings of his saber-rattling war council. So there we have this entire strategic thing. Now, in the background, let's also pay attention to the question of the dollar, because we're looking at a time now where dollar, oil, and geopolitics in some ways come together. The backdrop of Obama's trip to the Far East is the tremendous weakness of the U.S. dollar because of the trade deficits, really. The U.S. merchandise trade deficit is an even more serious problem than the federal budget deficit. The trade deficit is inherently harder to control because you're dealing with other sovereign entities in the world. So the backdrop of this is we saw that there were attempted support operations by a group of central banks in the previous week, as we reported. Support operations to keep the dollar from weakening too much, to support the dollar so that their own currencies, right, the Taiwan, South Korean currencies, and some others would not be priced out of the market because they're so expensive compared to the U.S. market. So we've got the chief executive of Hong Kong saying he is scared by the Federal Reserve 0% monetary policy, and well, he might be. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Radio again. Take a look at that Russia Today interview I did this week. You can see that at the YouTube Russia Today site. It sums up some of these points in a fairly concise way. Concerning the dollar weakness dominating, I think, a great deal of what's going on in the world, we have the Hong Kong chief executive, Donald Tsang, T-S-A-N-G, says on the Friday before Obama arrives, that would be a week ago today, he's frightened by loose U.S. monetary policy. Where is the money going? It's where the problem is going to be, Asia. You can see asset prices going up, not only in Korea, in Taiwan, in Singapore, and in Hong Kong, going up to levels that are incompatible or inconsistent with the economic fundamentals. What they're referring to is the dollar carry trade, the 0% lending by the Fed to the zombie banks, allows the zombie banks to take those dollars, sell them, driving down the dollar, right, contributing to dollar weakness massively, and then invest them in highly speculative ventures in the Far East. And this is also what Liu Mingkang, the number one bank regulator of the People's Republic of China, says, that the 0% lending binge by the Bernanke Fed is the main cause of massive speculation, new bubbles, asset bubbles, misallocation of capital. So this is the take from the Far East. They're attacking Bernanke, and well they might. He deserves it. We've also got some interesting things going on. One of the things you can do to fight this kind of economic warfare by the U.S. and the British is capital controls and exchange controls, right? If you don't like economic globalization and globaloney, well, great. One of the things you can do is slap on a capital controls and exchange controls. That was proven by Mahathir Mohamad, the genius prime minister of Malaysia back in 97, 98, 99, in the Asian contagion, or better yet, dollar contagion crisis. It was shown that Malaysia came out of this and lost less. They came out better than the countries that hadn't done it. So what we now have is Brazil imposing capital controls to stem the incoming tide of hot money. And hot money means hot dollars from Bernanke's 0% dollar carry trade. Taiwan froze the ability of foreign investors to place money in time deposits. And that would be attempt to speculate within the realm of the Taiwan dollar. These are big Asian tiger economies. And, of course, gold has reached an all-time high during the course of this week that we're just concluding now. So tremendous dollar weakness. Now, what's behind it now? If Bernanke keeps the 0% interest rate, that's going to fuel the worldwide asset bubble. But suppose he takes the advice of Barron's and others that he's got to start raising interest rates soon. Well, of course, that will bring down the U.S. stock market bubble. That will cause even more unemployment that you have. So within the realm of the Fed's monetary policy, there's no good solution. If you keep with the 0%, then you've got a crashing dollar and all the problems that come with that. And if you try to attract hot money back in with an interest rate increase, then you're going to be strangling even what little economic activity is left here. So this is where we get the temptation to do something like what I've called Operation Safe Haven. Operation Safe Haven starts from the idea, which is widespread in Wall Street, that if you have a big world crisis, a great fear, a shock, some kind of a stunning event, could be a false flag, could be a Gulf of Tonkin, could be a number of things. We'll go through some scenarios. But the basic idea is if people get scared, if they feel the cold breath of panic on their necks, they're going to run back to New York and reconvert into the dollar. Now, this is what was done. It was done by Kissinger in 73, 74 with the fake oil crisis, hooked up, Saltsjö Baden, Bilderberg meeting of that year and all the rest of it. Kissinger did one. Brzezinski, not to be outdone, did his in 1979. And the idea is if you drive up the price of oil, that sucks up a lot of dollars. So the pressure on the dollar is relieved. Now, what could it be? Well, Pakistani civil war. Yes, that's going on. Suppose the Pakistani civil war gets to be bigger. Suppose Islamabad falls to some military force. Or, even more likely, suppose the Taliban, so-called the Pakistani Taliban, the Al-Qaeda Taliban, get close to or get their hands on some of the Pakistani nuclear weapons. The U.S. is already taking advantage of that to try to seize the Pakistani nuclear weapons. Don't do it. If they did it, they'd probably give them to the Taliban to get this kind of a crisis. We've also got what we referred to a couple of times, the Houthi, H-O-U-T-H-I, a Shiite sect in Yemen. The Zaydites and the Houthis are the ones that are supported by Iran. This is a Shiite front against the Sunni Wahhabites of Saudi Arabia. Anyway, you've got a civil war in Yemen. Saudi Arabia supports the government. Iran supports the Houthi rebels. You've had shooting. You've had air raids. You've had some tank battles. And you have had some maritime incidents in the Gulf. Now, knowing that we're dealing with the old masters, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Brzezinski is always adamant. The U.S. military forces are already overextended. We do not need new wars. He's favorable of staying, favorable to staying in Afghanistan, but not starting new wars. So suppose you could play Saudi Arabia against Iran. Oh, it's a dream scenario for the Brzezinskiite faction. You don't have to do anything. You let Iran fight Saudi Arabia. As a result of this, the insurance rates on tankers in the Gulf will go sky high, and you don't even have to block the Straits of Hormuz, although you might do that. It's going to lead then to a tremendous disruption of oil. If the Persian Gulf oil is disrupted, who gets hit on the chin? Europe Japan, China. Well, so much the better. The U.S., of course, getting it from Africa, from Venezuela, from Alaska, from other sources. By the way, the British, remember, the British designed to have 10 highly modern nuclear reactors is also an attempt to make themselves a little bit more insulated against shenanigans like this. Suppose you have a coup d'etat in Saudi Arabia. Well, we almost had we have a reported coup d'etat back in August when Prince Bandar, the head of the National Security Council, attempted to interfere in the royal succession, presumably in his own favor, and was then put under house arrest. The world is still wondering, what happened to Prince Bandar? Where is he? Because he had been thought to have changed his coat, turned his coat from being Bandar Bush, the U.S. friend, to being the great friend of Putin and Russia. That would make a lot of sense for a smart guy like Bandar to do things like this. So anyway, how about a Gulf of Tonkin somewhere in the Persian Gulf? And again, the Israeli attack on Iran, I think, low on the list, because that then forces the U.S. to open up a new front, because the Israelis can start the war, but that's about all they can do. There's not much they can do against Iran. That would require the U.S. coming in, and everybody from Gates to Mullen to Brzezinski and so forth has said, no, 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 no. So what the Israelis will do, it seems to me, is to follow those orders, client state as they are. Now, the other thing that contributes to this Operation Safe Haven scenario, look what's going on in the U.S. We talked last week about the Major Hassan Patsy case in Fort Hood. I was able to talk with Alex Jones about this on his program. If you want to look up my essay, it's on approximately 2,500 websites around the world. You can look through actindependent.org. It'll be up on tarpley.net. quite soon. That upgrade is coming now. We've been promising it for some weeks, but it is coming. Anyway, find it anywhere you want. It's all over the place. That is the leading edge of a wave of Islamophobic hysteria. We'll be back in a minute. Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. Take a look at that Russia Today interview. Take a look at my essay on Major Hassan of Fort Hood, a patsy in a drill gone live. Because that's the thing. All the eyewitness accounts say everybody thought they were in a drill. There's a good chance that Hassan also thought that he was in a drill. But whether he was a criminal intent psychopath who wanted to kill or simply a patsy dupe who didn't know what he was walking into, he's a patsy. And that's the main thing. And all the stuff about, oh, how come nobody connected the dots and all this. We're going to have a board of inquiry with Togo West and a couple of retired admirals. Well, I'm sure they'll do whatever they can for the Gates Pentagon. But the fact is the guy's a patsy, and that fits into the context, right? We had Zazi, the guy from Flushing, Queens, and Denver, who supposedly wanted to blow up New York City. We got Major Hassan. We're going to have the KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Uber Patsy trial with four or five other super patsies going on trial with them. We've got a bunch of mosques being seized because they're allegedly the property of Bank Meli of Iran, therefore the Pasdaran Revolutionary Guard and the Alavi Foundation. There's a lot of ferment about that. There's a mosque here in Potomac, Maryland, which is actually a school, seems to be quite peaceful. They're being seized. So that's going to stir up quite a hornet's nest. You've also got this character, Pat Robertson, right, the religious demagogue. We have a new governor of Virginia. I've talked about him, McDonnell, a reactionary, with his Cuccinelli, his attorney general, an ultra-reactionary. Robertson says that Islam is not a religion, but it's a very destructive social system. So all kinds of things going on to gin up a big wave of hysteria, hatred, Islamophobia, Limbaugh running to get into it, Hannity, Levin, all the rest of these clowns pushing Islamophobia. So I think this, if you put this all together, it's time to be on the lookout for something in the Gulf in Pakistan. Pakistan not far from the Gulf. Something in Gwadar, maybe, that would lead to some big shock. Because they, again, Wall Street believes, whether it's true or not, that when you get the big shock, everybody takes the flight to quality, the flight to safety, and that means treasury bonds. Now, they're also worried because Saudi Arabia and other countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council are actually in the process of creating what amounts to an Arab currency unit. That's a big problem for them. The other thing is, whenever countries resolve their differences peacefully, that's a problem for the Anglo-Americans. Take a look, for example, at the meeting yesterday, I guess, of Russian Prime Minister Putin with the Ukrainian Prime Minister Timoshenko. This is now the natural gas pipeline question, and it looks to me like they have basically solved everything. The U.S. and British, Brzezinski and company, will not, repeat, not be able to gin up a crisis over the natural gas. Now, Yushchenko, the NATO puppet, the beneficiary of the color revolution, was on the same day meeting with Saakashvili of Georgia, and Putin said, I hope they have they don't be not so formal that they wear their ties to dinner, because when you go and have dinner with Saakashvili, you don't know what he's going to do with his tie. He's on film eating his tie, so he doesn't eat what he orders, but he eats his tie. So look at all that. Now, shifting gears, the other thing, big defeat for the international finance oligarchs. The Copenhagen conference is looking more and more like a failure. Let's not get overconfident. We have got to make sure that this Copenhagen conference is torpedoed, that it's blocked, breaks up, flies off in 1,000 directions. Block it. Gridlock is the best thing. In terms of the build-up to the Copenhagen conference, we have, of course, had the Barcelona conference, where most of the African delegations walked out, and then the walkout was sponsored by the non-aligned group, the so-called group of 77 non-aligned nations, although that's really about 130 countries these days. The 77 is obsolete, and it's now a misnomer. And the group representing the small island countries, all of them walked out in Barcelona because the arrogant rich elitists, in particular the Eurogarchs and Eurocrats, but also the Obama elitists and other wealthy countries, were not offering any development aid to the Africans. And, of course, that is the entire point. If you have cap and trade, carbon tax, you've got to remember that the U.S. Agricultural exports are the basis of the world market in wheat, in corn, in sugar, and to some extent in rice. This is also important. And if you impose this carbon tax on the U.S., one of the most immediately destructive consequences is that you will approximately double the export price of the U.S. wheat, corn, rice, sugar, and other things. So that's genocide. That will take, out of the 1 billion or so people largely in Africa that are on the verge of starvation, it will push them over. So there are lots of people in the world angry about this who want to reject it, and more power to them. They should reject it. And don't let them come back then in 2010. I think there's going to be a conference in Mexico City where they're going to keep trying. Okay, so the Copenhagen conference is now set to fail. Let's not get overconfident. We want it to fail. The report we have is that Obama is engaged in desperate last-minute secret diplomacy to try to get some kind of a face-saving interim compromise for these elitists, Malthusian ghouls, vampires, and Eurogarchs and Eurocrats and imperialists, too, because that's the main point. The secret meeting occurred at the White House between Obama and an unnamed European diplomat taking a leading role in this Copenhagen monstrosity of Malthusianism and genocide. So they're trying to work out an interim accord so they can show something as a fig leaf. Now, I take it that would be this guy Boer, B-O-E-R, who is the Eurocrat, Eurogarch, who is the manager of this. Remember that the plan was to have a U.S. cap-and-trade carbon monstrosity passed by the time of Copenhagen that would then be used to beat the other countries over the head, mainly to beat China and India over the head, because those are the two countries that say no, no thanks to being strangled under this carbon dictatorship so dear to the heart of the charlatan Al Gore, whom has been exposed once again on the Infowars.com website as basically fabricating, manufacturing, plagiarizing, and otherwise faking the evidence. The other thing is that we've got some of those German lemmings that came out for Barkey during the campaign. Remember, we had 200,000 German lemmings at the Brandenburg Gate. What a day of shame for Germany. Der Spiegel now has an editorial, the main sort of left-of-center news magazine, left-ogark, Eurogark magazine in Germany, that Obama has betrayed the cause, that he didn't tell the truth to Europeans. He promised that he would force through a global cap and trade, and now he hasn't done it. So the green fanatics are getting disenchanted with Obama. Another big flaw now emerging in Obama's coalition. There's also a fight between the Indian environmental minister and the U.S. Quackademic community, because he says the glaciers in the Himalayas are not shrinking that much, and the U.S. Quackademic Malthusians say, oh, no, you must be mistaken. The global warming is everywhere. So this is all happening. Now, shifting to economics per se, 500,000 new unemployment claims again this week, 500,000 plus. So the depression rolls on. The interesting news this week is the Geithner and Bernanke and Summers trio under heavy attack. We'll talk about that. I guess we're going to talk about that in the second segment of our second hour here. We're going to try to go to Phil Berg and get a report on the birth certificate interview. We'll be back in a minute.